Hi everyone, this is Sam. Before we start, this is a reminder about my book, Sort Your Head Out, Mental Health Without All the Bollocks, which is now a bestseller on Amazon. Thanks to everyone who's bought it and given it such wonderful reviews so far. If you haven't bought it yet, then head over to Amazon where it's available in hardback, Kindle edition and audiobook version narrated by me. You can also buy signed and dedicated copies via my website, samdelaney.co.uk, or from my local bookshop, barnesbookshop.co.uk. If you call or email them, they'll sort it out. Anyway, on with this week's episode. Hello, and welcome to The Reset, a mental health podcast without all the bollocks. I'm Sam Delaney. My guest this week is Simon Gunnin, CEO of the charity Calm, the campaign against living miserably. 125 people lose their life to suicide every week in the UK. 75% of all those suicides are male. Calm are on the front line of the fight against this, provoking conversation, providing life-saving services, and helping bring people together to help show them that life isn't always miserable, it is worth living, and to help them get the help they need when they need it. Simon's a really interesting and compelling bloke who came to Calm after a successful career in the media. He's helped to make the charity more high profile and effective than ever. I was interested to know more about the fight to cut suicide rates, but also his own personal story and how switching his career path has opened up a more fulfilling life for him. I hope you enjoy listening to our conversation. Simon, welcome to The Reset.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
It's a real pleasure, mate. Big fan of your organisation. We're going to talk about that. And all the fantastic work that you guys do at Calm. But before that, Simon, what I know less about is you, your own story, your own background. You know, what attracted you to working in the mental health sector? What experiences you had with this sort of stuff in your life?
Absolutely no experience whatsoever of working in charity, working in the mental health sector. Nothing at all. What attracted it to me, or me to it, I guess, is the chairman of Calm, a guy called James Scroggs, who is once met and never forgotten. He's about 6'8" and he wears a massive hat that takes him up to about 7'5". And bearing in mind, I'm about 5'7". It sort of creates for a bit of a comical picture when the two of us are together. But he asked me to go and have a look at it for a month or less, just because they parted company with the founding CEO. I was sort of in between things and or actually wasting time and energy doing stupid stuff, working for advertising agencies. And he said, go and have a look at it, or asked me if I'd just sort of advise them on what would be a way to take it. It was tiny at the time, 8 people in the office, in the head office, and 8 people on the helpline, less than $1 million in revenue. But there was something straight away that really struck me about the brand and about how it was able to help people who weren't helped by anything else. And it really resonated with me. And then also seeing the way that people reacted to it, the love that they have for Calm, was something that meant that 6 years later, I'm still doing it and still loving it.
And what was your personal attitude to mental health? How had, you know, it touched your life, the issues that you guys deal with now at Calm? Was it something that you felt personally?
Well, I worked in media of various types. So in the music business, and then telly, and then back to the music business, and then advertising. And there's a book, and I cannot remember who wrote it, called Affluenza. Who wrote that? Is a kind of It's not Alain de Botton, but it's somebody like that, isn't it? It's somebody, isn't it?
Yeah.
And in that, he talks about the marketing condition and about this inability to compare yourself with what's going on kind of below you down the advantage scale, but only ever to compare how people are doing when they're doing better than you, you know, compare yourself to it and constantly beat yourself up. So I'd had a pretty bruising time at an advertising agency, which was, yeah, it was pretty brutal. Left there, lost my job, frankly, and had quite a lengthy period of time where, for one reason or another, I just didn't get another job, and it dragged me down. It was just this whole, my dad I guess, had sort of instilled stuff in me, you know, you just value, your only value that you place on yourself is your job when yeah. you're a middle-aged man. And not having one, I found like was like just being hit repeatedly by a train every day, you know. I was consulting for people, so I was going in and working with more, frankly, you know, people are probably in the same position working in ad agencies and trying to help improve the, get this right, what a way to live your life. I was consulting people trying to get the valuation of their ad agencies up. I mean, what are you doing? Do something with some value to it. That's what I was doing, but really, really needed some stability. Having had that kind of instilled in me completely that you are, all you are is your job, right? All you are is what you talk about. You know, all you talk about is your job. And I felt kind of more and more diminished by not having one. It's weird, isn't it, that somebody else that you don't even know, you need their affirmation. You just need somebody to say, come on, come and work for me. And that suddenly that's going to make everything okay. And in the end, it was sort of did, because 6 years later, and I'm still very happily at Calm. Definitely proud of what we do, which I'm not sure you can really, is really true when, especially if you're, you know, in a job where you're trying to flog washing powder and stuff like that. I didn't find that very motivating. Not like the old, I used to make records. I found that very motivating. This is better.
It is different. If you feel like you're making some sort of cultural contribution that might make people happy and enrich them in some way, and people are making money along the way, that feels somehow, that sits better with most of us, doesn't it? But it can be difficult when you feel like what you're putting back into the community or into society isn't necessarily enriching anyone's life. It's difficult, but, you know, I always say we all have to make a living. The vast majority of us don't really have the luxury of making much of a choice in how we make that living.
Absolutely.
And ultimately it is about self-esteem, I suppose, and identity, but also it's about just putting food on the table, isn't it? I mean, I've been in situations like the one you describe. It's always had a very big effect on me, on my mental health. It's been one of the main triggers. So when you speak about this, it's really, really, I can relate to it deeply. And, you know, especially once you've got kids as well, however modern you might think you are, I think, you know, we and hopefully it's just our generation and our sons won't be the same. We still, however modern we are in terms of our relationship with our wives or whatever, we still have sort of quite an old fashioned sense of ourselves in the background, don't we? Of how you've got to be putting food on the table, you've got to be the breadwinner. And it seems so old fashioned on the one hand, but so many mates of mine, people I speak to, they know it's there inside of them. They know that voice is there. And so when they do find themselves struggling with work, that can really tip them into a dark place.
But it's a luxury of the comfortable classes, though, isn't it? To not only feel that you have to put food on the table, you have to have loads of food left over, but you also have to have some, your prestige. That's the word, isn't it? Prestige. There has to be prestige about how you put the food on the table. That there's and it is a luxury. I mean, it's like, You don't get revolutions without a comfortable middle class, right? Where you can start worrying about things that are less hand to mouth. But I do wonder if perhaps not worrying so much about the prestige of what you're doing, or whether you feel that you're living up to other people's expectations, whether that is a good thing. It's the old. Do you remember James? Do you remember the band James?
Yeah, yeah.
I worked with them for a bit. It was absolutely brilliant. But that lyric, if I hadn't seen such riches, I could live with being poor.
Yeah, great lyric. I often think of that line, yeah.
He's such a lovely bloke, Tim. He's a lovely, lovely, clever, wise man, and really sort of kind with it as well. And and that's really stuck with me. But it's also patronising, isn't it? That kind of, if only I were a simple farmer.
Yeah.
It's so bloody patronising, because actually putting food on the table when it's hard to put food on the table, that's got to be the toughest of all things, isn't it? I find myself very conflicted with my opinion of myself. And I'm sure all of us sort of comfortable, well-off comparatively well-off people do, that whilst we beat ourselves up for the sort of the values that have been, I guess, enforced on us, it also does feel to me extremely kind of first world problem to be complaining about the fact that you're working for the wrong record company or the wrong television company.
That's true, but it exists, doesn't it? And it's tough. And one of the things that I often go back to, and I've written about a lot, is this first world problems idea. Is like, sometimes when you're in the midst of it, it just makes problems worse because you start to beat yourself up because you're aware that this is not, you know, that you're aware that this is not life or death. Are you aware maybe that you're being slightly self-indulgent, or you're comparing yourself to people who are much worse off than you? And that compounds the sense of shame and guilt about your depression, because you sort of think, oh my God, not only do I feel miserable, I feel ashamed of how miserable I am, because I'm aware of how privileged I am.
Completely, which adds to this lack of self-worth. It's that horrible spiral of not feeling that you're entitled to feel miserable. And that it's not a class thing. I don't think it's anything to do with the amount of money you're earning or what you do to earn that money. But it's like beat yourself up because you can't control your emotions is so counterintuitive, because the whole nature of emotion is that you can't control it. And any amount of rationality probably isn't going to solve that, unless it's a very long period of time and somebody very clever telling you how to do it. But that was a very long answer, wasn't it, Sam? But yeah.
Oh, well, I don't really think of these chats as questions and answers. They're just sort of like, you know, beautifully meandering conversations. Where do you think, I want to ask you about this. It's a really interesting subject to me, like work and its relationship with our identity and our mental health. And I know that obviously, particularly when Calm started out, I know it's widened its sort of remit a lot since then. It was about men and, you know, looking in particular at the high suicide rates amongst men, middle-aged men in particular. And I think, do you think that it's particularly pronounced in our generation? You mentioned the way your dad raised you. Do you think that, you know, we are Thatcher's children and we learnt to value ourselves on the basis of our own productivity?
Totally. That, I mean, it's definitely stuck with us. But I think that when we think about it as Thatcher's children, which is a really good way of looking at it, and our net contribution, that sort of way of looking at things, I don't see. I mean, I guess Thatcher was older than a boomer, wasn't she? I don't know what she would be. She's dead now, though, isn't she? That was an outside influence, but the horrible fact of it is that for men of our age, suicide has followed right the way through our lives. We as a cohort from age 16 to age 50 have been the most prone to suicide of any group. Prior or since, there's got to be something. If you step back from it and think about what circumstance it is, if you were born in the 60s or 70s, what circumstances surround you? And the one to me that sticks out is probably the Second World War. It's probably that, and the influence of that generation sort of coming out of the horrendous austerity of post-war, let alone the experience of the Second World War, what that did to our grandparents and parents, and how that affected our cohort. I mean, it is a scientific fact. It isn't bleating that if you are now in your certainly in your 50s, then the suicide has been a constant part of, as over-indexed as a constant part of life.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. And I've never heard that said before. I'm really interested to know more about the war and how it's been passed on through a generation of our grandparents who lived in it, our parents who were probably born during it and suffered that kind of initial trauma, probably literally a lot of them just being babies while bombs were dropping and then growing up in the sort of aftermath and the rubble of, and all of it. And then, you know, we come 10, 20 years, 30 years after that. And how do you think, it was their communication, their ability to communicate and show emotion had been so sort of almost destroyed or repressed by the experience of war that we couldn't form kind of emotional bonds properly with them.
Yeah, I wonder if that is it. I mean, I do wonder if, like, for my dad, who was born at sort of at the start of the Second World War, if the bloke next door is dead and the other side doesn't have any legs or has, you know, had the most horrendous, awful experiences, and then that there's still the post-traumatic experience of the First World War around as well. I wonder if then that the ability to ask for help, to consider your own position relative to the rest of society is somewhat, you know, hindered. Do you know the comedian Tony Law? He's the most dangerously funny bloke. I saw him in the summer at Edinburgh, and honestly, I prolapsed about 7 times out of 4 different points. He's just absolutely brilliant. And he's talking about why are kids so tall? Why are they? How are they so massive? And he says it's access to the good victuals. That's what it is. He says we had access to some of the good victuals, but they got access to all the good victuals, and that's why they're all 9 feet tall. And so there's food, vegetables, and dairy, but then there's that emotional permission, maybe maturity, whatever you might want to call it, but from my dad, you know, it was like the only physical contact I ever had with my dad was a brisk handshake, or I remember I touched his foot when he was already dead in his hospital bed, and that really stuck with me because it just wasn't, you know, you've got kids, I've got now a massive lumbering 16-year-old boy because he's had access to the good victuals, so he's massive. But you know, we spent our entire time together the last 16 years jumping on each other's heads and raspberries off the back of each other's necks and rolling the floor and, you know, all of that really good stuff. So he's had access to the good emotional victuals. I hope that he's got that. I hope that he's got access to stuff that, yeah, it's, I mean, I could be self-pitying about it as well. I said I didn't have, but certainly, you know, my dad didn't have any of that. He didn't have any of that kind of relationship. I've got an older brother as well. He didn't have any relationship with us like I have with Patrick.
I said to my dad recently, I said, how was your relationship with your dad? And he seemed quite surprised that I would ask a question of that nature, because even a question like that feels a little bit sort of overstepping the mark.
Relationship? I didn't have one.
What are you talking about, relationship? Where'd you get these words from? It was a bit like that. And, I remember my grandfather. He died, like, when I was sort of in my early 20s. And I remember him being, you know, he's a sort of a very warm, twinkly-eyed Irishman who was funny and entertaining to his grandchildren. And so I thought, I hear these stories about men of that generation, the war generation, and how they were very emotionally remote. But my memories of my granddad was this extremely entertaining guy. And so I said to my dad, what was it, you know, did you ever talk to him about his work or what he'd been through? My dad just sort of laughed and went, no, I never had a conversation more than 5 minutes with him in my life, right? And I thought, oh, it's really interesting because he never seemed cold or remote to me. But at the same time, he could be funny, but the idea of a long or deep conversation with one of his sons, my dad like laughed at the idea of that and said, you know, he was from a different generation, and he was really, for most of my adult life and adolescent life, he goes, I could see all he was trying to do was get his head around the modern world, right? He was trying to get his head around it, and it was a bloody struggle because things changed so much, so rapidly in terms of the way people behaved and spoke after the war. And he passed that on to my dad. And I don't think, I mean, I didn't live with my dad, but, and my dad's a warm guy in some ways, but certainly, as you describe, my relationship with my son is similar to how you describe yours. You know, we kind of, I think our generation of dads, so that I see this amongst a lot of my mates as well with their kids, you act a bit like a big brother. You're halfway between a parent and a big brother a lot of the time, or a mate, a more responsible older mate, because you still do the mucking about, don't you? You muck about with your son. Yeah. I do. Sounds like you do. Yeah. And I think that, I hope that that's very good for them. You know, sometimes you think, oh, maybe I'm not setting a good example of being very responsible and sensible and adult like my father was as a role model to me. But I think, you know, it is, you know, you've made me realize it is radically different, really, isn't it? Our generation's approach to fathering.
That's a good point, isn't it? I've never considered that, actually, about am I doing the right thing? Our patron, Professor Green Stephen, said to me a couple of years ago, are we doing the right thing talking about this stuff? Are we, as in suicide, are we or are we normalising it? And that stuck with me. And I think we are. I know we are doing the right thing. But yeah, I don't, it's, I guess every generation is going to think they're doing it right, aren't they? Everyone's going to think that we've got it sus. We've moved on from the predecessors in the way that our dads were unable to, well, didn't act like big brothers, act like mates. But there's no arbiter, is there? I sort of think that life's going to end up like a film, you know, and there's going to be an end, and we'll work out what happened. Of course, that's not true at all. And are we doing it right? I suppose we don't know. We've got to kind of wing it and carry on doing it how we are, and hope that we are. But I've been thinking, I don't know why, I've been thinking a lot about my dad recently, and what he was like when he was my age, and then think about my granddad and what he was like. I don't know when he was my age, but when he was a bit older, you know, like he wore a tie every day of his life.
Yeah,
my granddad was a brickie, and my dad worked for advertising agencies. You know, go figure. But my dad, when he was my age, was so old. You know, he didn't, or maybe am I a man child because I spend spare moments just endlessly looking at football on Twitter or researching what pair of Nikes I want next. You know, what am I? What have I become? Am I still...
Strongly relate.
What am I?
I hear what you're saying, and I think that has to be considered self-care, Simon. I do.
I've just bought a pair of Jordan mids. I'm really pleased because they're red pandas and I couldn't... What am I?
No, I don't think you can feel bad on yourself. I think that, you know, you stay in touch with the things that a lot of the things that brought us pleasure and joy and excitement when we were teenagers. And now you look back and think, oh my God, what a waste of time and effort that was, you know. But that doesn't mean that you throw the baby out of the bathwater. There are a huge number of things, like in your case and mine, locating rare trainers that you've always wanted to buy since. And I think that's, you know, if you're lucky enough to be able to buy them, then you buy them because Jesus Christ, you know, life is tough. Sources of joy are scarce, and, yeah, and you need to find what works for you. You know,
I go to see a fair few bands as well, and I wonder what sort of state of arrested development am I in until I get to the venue to go and see Fontaine's DC and see that it's just full of blokes in their 40s and 50s. And then I'm going to see Yard Act week after next or so. It'll be the same. Dry cleaning. Well, it's the 60s hats.
Have you seen Self Esteem is selling hats at her gigs that say Six Music Dad on them?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, that's official Self-Esteem merch. It doesn't even say Self-Esteem on them anywhere, but it was her idea. And her, apparently, by the way, her gigs are incredible. And they're selling Six Music Dad caps. So I'm actually going, and I fully intend to buy one because, you know, you have to own this stuff. I know it's not meant entirely kindly, but yeah. I don't know about you. I'm happy to embrace it.
I'm totally happy to embrace it. No, I am. But I certainly, when I you sort of go to see Idols and you think, bloody hell, I'm pushing it here. I haven't lost it.
Yeah, and then everyone there, you're the youngest there, mate.
Yeah. And it's just, you think, no, I'm not. So, it's good for the soul. It has to be good for the soul. And that we are, I mean, I guess part of it is technology and access to information and access to different sorts of relationships with the world that our dads just didn't have. I suppose that must be a part of it. But actually, I guess, if we were we to have a trained professional psychiatrist or psychologist or something with us now, they'd probably say that a bit of arrested development is a good thing, that gaining the joy of all of that stuff Actually, I've got a motorbike as well, but I suppose that's always been a bit of an older bloke's kind of thing, isn't it? Tinkering with the motorbike.
It's a really interesting subject, this, and I think that I hope that there is less guilt and shame around it than there once was, because there were a lot of, you know, there was the cliche of the sort of middle-aged bloke, you know, still being a bit cool and trendy. And, you know, I guess middle-aged blokes were sort of made to feel a little bit ashamed of that, you know, and there were certain tropes around that, midlife crisis tropes. But I see it more and more. And, you know, I'm 47. I had I held an event for the Reset last October, and a lot of my brother, who's 10 years older than me, was there, and he has a sort of a radio show that he puts out with very good music every Saturday on a local sort of digital radio station. He's got a great podcast that he's very passionate about. Another friend of mine who actually works in advertising, you might know him, has just told me he's a creative guy, and he's in his 60s, learned to play guitar and formed a band.
Good.
I won't name that band or the individual on air, because I think he's keeping it low profile while they play gigs under the radar. But I remember saying to my brother, I think it's really good, and that there are a lot of people who are, you know, older guys who are family men and they've got their career, but they've got creative passions and things that just bring them pleasure and joy outside of their work and their family is absolutely essential. Because I definitely think a lot of guys of our dads and certainly our granddad's generation, you know, my grandfather sort of sat in his armchair and was pretty lonely just watched sport on TV, but that was it. Yeah. You know, didn't really have many connections with people outside. You know, it's him and his wife. They never got on that well, really. They're kind of cantankerous couple. And you see that a lot, you know. And my dad, you know, who I remember when I was a kid and I'd see him at weekends, he's a very sort of like creative, funny guy with a lot of different passions. For things like music and books and nature and photography. Now he's, you know, he lives on his own. And, you know, I think that some guys just think you get to an age and you stop. And I think our generation isn't. And that is a healthy thing. When we talk in the context of male suicide, male depression, stuff like that, it's a healthy thing for people to hold on to some creative passions, I think, isn't it?
Yes, it has to be. And if your mate wants another guitarist, I'm desperate to be in a band. I've never been in a band.
Well, listen, I will tell you off air about this band. It's quite an impressive band. Its lineup and its average age. And I found it very inspirational and exciting. The only problem is he will not tell me where they're playing. I know they're playing, but he won't yet tell me, because I think they need to get good first. But yep. I think things like that are great. And I think, but maybe it's just because I myself now am middle-aged, I think from a social point of view that the stigma and the jokes that might have been more prevalent in the 80s and 90s about midlife crisis man with a pair of leveled leather trousers and a Porsche, right, are less prevalent now. And if the worst criticism you can get is being, well, a few years ago, it was centrist dad, another thing I was more than happy to embrace. And then it became six music dad. And there's a big overlap between those two things. I think that's the worst that you have. You're happy to go with it, aren't you?
I think, though, whilst we're talking about all this stuff, we're guilty of buying into that negative connotation of all of this. And so Sean Lott, you know, a lovely, funny man. And he has a thing he talks about when getting a motorbike in middle age, which I did. So I've got a big old Triumph that I ride around with my mates. And it's really, really important to me. It's a part of who I am now. And I love it. And I like just sometimes I just stand in the living room and look at it outside. I don't bring it indoors, but I would if I was allowed. No. And he talks about, why is it wrong getting a motorbike when in your middle age? And it said, if you do that and you're riding along, people will just come out onto the streets. All the school kids will come out of the school and just to watch you go past, and the teachers will say, "Oh, here comes the funny man on his motorbike." Everybody come outside, and they'll go out on the street, and as he rides past, they'll go, "Wanker!" and that's sort of buying into this thing. And then he says it's not a middle-aged crisis, it's a midlife crisis. It's because you realise your days are limited and you want to do something that you enjoy. And actually, I don't think it is that. I think that's wrong. I think that the midlife crisis thing still continues. And I think it's one of those little things that we allow to laugh at, a bit like sort of man flu, do you know what I mean? We allow ourselves to laugh at it, we give it permission, because we're in a position of unbelievable privilege as middle-aged white men living in houses that they own. You know, we've got to remember to look at that privilege while we talk about this stuff. But it is just one of those things, when we see that, and here you go, look, I'm going to bring it right back to the serious now. So when we see that suicide rate that's followed the cohort through our entire lives, I think things like that have to be challenged. And for generations just or people in their 30s now, for example, I hope that will be challenged, that midlife crisis principle, which still has connotations of silly man, silly frivolous man, doesn't concentrate on the right things, doesn't really do his duty, isn't serious enough really, isn't taking his responsibilities seriously enough. It has those connotations. And it is a problem when you look at the rates of poor mental health and suicide in men in their 50s and 40s. It dramatically is a huge problem. So I think, like, where we try to break down kind of cliches, stupid, jokey cliches amongst other groups in society, and we make great progress in some and not so much in others. I think that is something else that will be broken down probably by our behaviour. So maybe we've just done a full Stuart Lee there, Sam, and we've brought it right the way back round. We've done the full callback, because maybe our being excited by trainers, maybe be excited by going to see self-esteem and yard act. Maybe what we're doing actually is we're giving permission to our boys that you don't have to change who you are as you get older, that you don't have to impose limits on what you want to be at any point in your life. You can choose what you want to be today. You can choose what you want to be tomorrow if it's completely different to what you were. Or you can just choose it. I just want to be 15 forever, which doesn't sound too bad.
But yeah, I think how you just put that is beautiful, actually, because I think that, you know, I wrote this in my book in that I kind of got conflicted, because I wasn't, in the end, I proved unwilling or unable to sort of change my identity as much as I thought maybe some people, whether it was my dad or whoever, wanted me to. Feel ashamed. You feel ashamed because you've got an idea of who you think you should be becoming. Well, you don't become that person. You feel ashamed. And then you kind of get a bit older, and hopefully you get a bit more enlightened and chilled about it. And you think, actually, it's all right to just carry on taking pleasure in some of the things I took pleasure in 20 years ago. There's no, why should there be a rule that I have to evolve out of that and suddenly be wearing a tie, you know?
One of the things that gets to me, though, is when I think about my dad, when he was like, I remember his 50th birthday really well. And he didn't wear flash trainers. He didn't buy music. He didn't do all the things that I do, you know, like, that the assumption is that therefore he was happy with that. Maybe he wasn't, because I can't compare myself to him, because he was so completely, radically, unbelievably different with all the frankly shite that I surround myself with, that I take pleasure in. He was so profoundly different. And the assumption is that therefore he was happy with that, but I'm better because I've got more stuff. Maybe he wasn't happy. Maybe he was desperately wished that, you know, he could expand or re-enlist. I would say expand his horizons, but maybe it's just re-enlist some of the stuff that you get excited about when you're young, but you get beaten out of you because you're told you're not allowed to have it.
Just going back to your career, it's really fascinating in the way that you found yourself in a not particularly great place, and you weren't particularly happy, and you had a period like that. And then it almost seems so left field that you wound up here doing this. Now, you probably, you know, having been through recovery for the last 8 years, I do have some pretty weird ideas about the universe and its intervention that most people who are more rational don't want to hear about. But when I hear a story like that, I think, kind of like that bruising experience you said in your last job, you weren't that happy when you were doing bits and bobs for other people. And then this comes completely out of the blue. And suddenly what you're doing is a job with real meaning, in which I'm guessing you must feel every day that you are genuinely helping people in need. There's something that, I mean, you know, I don't want you to necessarily buy into the idea of universe intervention, but it was a pretty amazing thing to have happened in your life, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is. It definitely is. And I'm really grateful to James Scroggs for asking me to do it, and then for sticking with me as we've taken the thing from one sort of state to a profoundly different one. So we're now completely radically different to where we were 5 years ago in relation to our size, which you'd measure that in money and in employees and things, but our impact, our helpline is so much bigger than it was. But I think mainly through our campaigns and the number of people that we reach, it's a profoundly different thing. And I'm really grateful to James for letting me do that, because he's kind of had my back throughout it, and we've managed to surround myself with brilliant people who work at Calm. But I guess there is something sort of weirdly poetic about it, I suppose. I mean, what I find really interesting as well is that when I was going to start doing it, I had a lot of mates from telly, music, advertising kind of areas that took the piss. It was the most depressing thing you could possibly do, and you've got to get out of there and start doing what you did before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just make sure it's temporary. But it isn't like that. It's a joyful place to be. It's creative, and it's full of dedicated people who are really good at what they do. And the same can't be said for everywhere that I've worked.
No, absolutely not. There is also something that you discover. I think some people are born with it. Some people discover it young. I've certainly discovered it as I've got older, and just as I've got older and I've been through various things in my life, is that there is something genuinely, I don't want to sound trite or smug, but doing stuff for other people is kind of like, it's quite good in a selfish way too. I think that it brings you a sense of, you know, sort of fulfillment and contentment that just isn't possible, no matter how much your career might be flying in another area that isn't like tangibly helping people who need help.
And we come back to this a lot in our work, in the way that we try to position ourselves and the messages to people that say it's okay to ask for help, because there's a dopamine exchange that in helping somebody else, and I'm not talking about what I do, by the way, I mean just like genuinely in helping someone else. When you give, if you do give money to somebody who's, you know, in a right old mess, you get a small, I'm talking about, you know, somebody on the street who needs some money, for example, just as a tangible example, that you do get a little drop of dopamine yourself. And I think it's a basic human, if it is dopamine, but it's a basic human condition that we're kind of hoist by the fact that our brains are so, you know, overdeveloped, that we question whether it's all right to lust after a pair of trainers. We question where we are in life all the time. We compare ourselves to the person who's got more rather than the person who's got less. And we analyze until we get into what we were talking about before. That's kind of emotionally driven feedback that overrides our rational brain. But what that overdeveloped brain has also given us is communication, right? And the ability to ask for help. But the communication linguistically has led us to become very efficient pack animals, which means that we rely on each other for different roles. So we did some research. Actually, this was a male bit of research. We found that 84%, or we asked about 2,000 men, 84% of them wanted to be the one that helps their mates, wanted to be the one that's there for them. And we took that into quite a lot of the work that we've done with Carling around football, and a bit like this notion of teams of captains, that we all want to be the one that helps. There's a downside to that, because does that mean that we all want to be the strong one and when the rest of the week? But I don't think it is that. I think that's this basic human development that means that we operate in a pack mentality, and that we understand that we're going to use a very unfortunate analogy then, but you know, we're stronger together. Mm. And that, I think, is a, it feels to me, I'm making this up, right? I'm guessing, but it feels to me that that's a basic human, basic part of humanity, is that we want to help people in Ukraine, in Turkey. We want to help people who are close to us. And the news might kind of belie that, might make us doubt that today as we're recording. It's the agenda has switched back to small boats because, you know, they're the real villains in all this, right? They're not the ones that arrive in small boats, not the ones that arrive in private jets. But that's the distraction technique for today, is terrifying foreigners trying to give better lives to their children. But the truth of it is that we live in a kinder, safer place than any other humans, if not place geographically, place in time. Or just time would be a better way of putting it, wouldn't it? Place in time. We live in a kinder, safer time than any time in humanity. And just all the work that we do is reliant on, in this case, British people wanting to look after other people. That's how calm exists. It's a movement. We are leading a movement. We're not the movement. I think that is because we get pleasure out of helping others.
So my last question is, you know, what calm are doing is fulfilling a huge need, you know, in our society. And what calm also have done is really helped to highlight, amidst all the, you know, you're right, the news cycle that is just a constant distraction from the real problems. You know, you've done a lot of work in your research to also highlight just how profound the kind of mental health epidemic is in this country. There doesn't seem to be much. It feels to me like Calm and other organizations too are having to fill a gap that the government aren't. So what's the future? Because, you know, everything that I read in your research suggests that this is a huge crisis that, you know, no one in the mainstream media is really taking seriously enough.
Not in any way.
Just going to be dependent on Calm and not the NHS going forward.
Yeah, I mean, it's maybe this is all part of it. Maybe this is because government is run by men in their 60s and late 50s. Maybe they can't grapple the issue. Maybe the majority of them think that it's embarrassing and that it's about, you know, they all went to Eton, didn't they? You're not allowed to talk about your feelings if you went to Eton.
Well, I don't know if you've read that James Beard book, Richard Beard's Sad Little Men, about the way in which that those public schools, you know, almost train people to, they train them out of empathy.
Yeah.
And these are the guys who've been running the country for the last 13 years.
Well, I hope it's not a name drop. I think he's been on this. I was having a chat with Alistair Campbell.
He's
a wildly entertaining man. He was saying that when he would ride down the Strand in a government car with Gordon Brown, he knew absolutely that Gordon wanted to get out of the car and go and help the people sleeping rough on the Strand. He desperately wanted to get out and help them. Whereas I don't think Suella Braverman does. And and I don't think Johnson does. I don't think Gove or any of the rest of them do. And that might be because they've had empathy battered out of them. But I don't think, though, that they're going to have some moment of reflection and revelation and understand that actually trainers are good fun and that it's all right to care about people. To answer your question, yes, it's something which is our biggest referrer to our helpline now, which takes much more than half our revenue to run. Our biggest referrer is the NHS. So that's doctors and people in hospital, nurses, et cetera, who are saying we don't have the services. You ring the Calm helpline. And this is a free-to-call service, but we are not able to deal with that amount of pressure. Don't get me wrong, I'm not blaming the NHS for referring to us. They're desperately trying to help people. But it's at a point where that you sometimes just kind of feel like turning the table over, do you know what I mean? And sort of saying, well, okay, we'll have to do it. Government isn't going to do it. It's not, there isn't any kind of, there just isn't any motivation to help. There's no energy. There's no understanding that just even the base economics of the situation. So 121 people a week die by suicide. Each one of those costs £1.68 million to the state. So that's just about 13 billion a year that is taken out of the Treasury, or that's one PPE contract for a publican, you know, that is taken out of the public coffers. So that's trite, but that isn't something which is accepted. But when we look at productivity, when we look at the fact that services for children are non-existent, mental health services for children are non-existent, we're sitting on a massive bomb that actually all of the emotional development in the world isn't going to help. We need services. We need huge amounts of money put into the NHS to deal with the backlog in care, and the effects of lockdown and the rest of it is coming our way, along with what is clearly identifiable as a key root of suicide and suicidality, which is economic hardship. So 2008 saw the biggest rise in that group that we've been talking about, basically. So then it was men 45 saw the biggest rise in history in suicide in that group. Not in that group, but the biggest rise of anybody was in that group in after the crash in 2008, when they lost their jobs, we lost our jobs. That's coming our way too. You know, this is something which is terrifying. We're getting more traction. We're getting more inquiries. We're getting people wanting to talk about stuff, but we don't see any solutions coming from government at all.
Terrible stuff, but thank God that Calm are doing the work that they do. And what you've done there, Simon, is amazing. And what you shared today is amazing as well. It's absolutely fascinating talking to you. Thanks ever so much for joining us. And keep up all the incredible work.
Thanks, Sam. I will. Thanks very much for having me.
That was Simon Gunning, a brilliant bloke doing amazing work at a fantastic charity. To find out more, go to thecalmzone.net. And if you enjoy the podcast, why not subscribe to The Reset at samdelaney.substack.com? You get exclusive writing from me, plus bonus podcasts and a bunch of other stuff, including my huge appreciation. Oh, and also, follow me on Instagram at The Reset Sam, where I've started posting regular video content too. Until next time, gang, thanks for listening, be lucky, and don't let the dickheads get you down.